Good evening. Good evening, everyone. We're about to get started. I think everybody has found a seat or is about to do so. So it's my great honor to welcome you to this wonderful event. My name is Ian Haney Lopez. I'm a law professor here at the law school. Some of my students know me as Halo. And if that's all they call me, I'm actually pretty good with that. So let's just stick with that. Okay, so this is the 20th birthday of the International Human Rights Law Clinic. Pretty amazing. It was started in 1998. Laurel Fletcher, who's one of our speakers this evening, was the first staff attorney. Roxana Althaus was a student in the first class. Today they are co-directors of the International Human Rights Law Clinic. So it's pretty amazing. We're really thrilled. 20 years. Now, some of you, I think most of you have celebrated, some of you just recently celebrated your 20th birthday. Yes. And this is going to be a good birthday, and like all good birthdays, there's no intent to end it anytime soon. So there's actually going to be three events. This is the first. Next week, Navi Pillay, who's a human rights lawyer and was head of the International Human Rights Commission, she will be here. And I'm actually very excited because she was a lawyer in South Africa when I was a student, and I spent a semester in her office working, more or less. It's not clear that she'll remember me, but I remember her. Okay, so she's going to be here next week. Then November 1st, there'll be three human rights lawyers from Latin America. So this is the first of three events. We really hope to see you at all three events. Also in the theme of not ending the party, after tonight's formal discussion, there's going to be a reception upstairs. Now, the International Human Rights Center itself cannot legally drink, but there will be alcohol. So just, you know, don't give the Human Rights Law Clinic any alcohol, but you all can partake. Okay. Let me say a little bit more about Laurel and Michelle. This is going to be, when we think of the International Human Rights Law Clinic, I think if you think international human rights, the word international really stands out. But this is really a conversation about human rights. And the International Human Rights Law Clinic has always done work, not only internationally, but domestically, thinking through issues of social justice here in the United States through a human rights frame. In terms of racial justice, in terms of wages for low-income workers. And this is going to be a conversation between Laurel and Michelle about moving from a civil rights frame, which has been the predominant frame that we've used since the mid-1900s, in thinking about racial justice, to a human rights frame, a frame that asks us to think about human rights and human dignity. So that's the conversation. Laurel Fletcher is a powerhouse lawyer, an incredible human rights litigator, a fabulous professor, and for reasons that I understand, she does not put this on her resume, but she was a classmate of mine at law school. And so all of you law students need to pay attention. You're thinking that some of the most annoying people in your classes, you will be rid of them in just a few years. It's not true. You may end up stuck with them for your entire professional career. And you may be thinking, does that mean that whatever I say or do in law school matters? No, take heart. Whatever you say in law school or college or high school, don't worry. If you need to, you can take an oath before the Senate Judiciary Committee and lie your ass off. It's all going to work. Michelle Alexander, two words, superstar. One word, superstar? Two words, because you need to draw it out. Superstar. Author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, a book that helped crystallize the injustice of racialized mass incarceration, that gave us a vocabulary, that gave us a frame to understand everything that was being done, that was instrumental in helping spur and energize a movement to end mass incarceration. Just phenomenal. Also, though, some of you may know this, also the author of a piece in 2016 called Why Hillary Clinton Doesn't Deserve the Black Vote. And can I just say, Hillary did not read the piece in time. Because just a few days after the piece was published, she was confronted by a racial justice activist with material from Michelle's piece. And Clinton was shocked, just shocked, that anybody remembered that she had described black teenagers as super predators who needed to be brought to heel. And can I just say, dog whistle politics bites back. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so one of the most exciting things, too, about Michelle is Michelle Alexander has just come aboard the New York Times as a regular op-ed columnist. This is huge. Now, New York Times, paper of record, so centrist that it is described as the old gray lady. Now, I don't know exactly what Michelle's tenure is going to be like, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be a wild ride for that old gray lady. So please, I want you to join me. I would love it if you stood up. I would love it if you stood up and gave a very, very warm welcome to Laurel Fletcher and Michelle Alexander. A quick word on the format, then I'll turn it over to them. They're going to engage in conversation for half an hour or so. In the meantime, there are cards circulating. You have the cards, write a question. The cards will be picked up by people walking the aisles. Then I'll bring the cards up. They'll take a few questions. Now would be a great opportunity to turn off your phone. And, like, nobody's moving because you already did. Yeah, okay. So turn off your phone. Get ready for a great conversation. If you have a question, write it down on the note card. Pass it to the aisle, and let's get started.
Thank you again. Okay. This is interesting. Well, welcome. And thank you, Michelle, my dear friend. I'm so glad that you agreed to come in and be in conversation tonight. Before we begin, we got some swag for you. We got gifts. So we have our little phone wallet from the International Human Rights Law Clinic. Take it into the old gray lady. And our, spare no expense here, our anniversary t-shirt.
Thank you.
Wear it in good health.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
All right, well, let's get started. I thought we would start with the present moment, because the present moment feels pretty important to the country. It's pretty laden right now. So in your debut op-ed for the New York Times, you use this metaphor of a river to describe the centuries-long struggle for human freedom by those who are oppressed. Now, that was a really powerful metaphor. And you quote Vincent Harding describing the American black freedom struggle, quote, like a river, sometimes powerful, tumultuous, and roiling with life, at other times meandering and turgid, covered with the ice and snow of seemingly endless winters, all too often streaked and running with blood. And that really resonated it resonated for me when I read it. It resonates even more strongly this last week, and particularly today. It feels like we're on the verge of something here. And so given what we're witnessing in this moment with the Kavanaugh confirmation, in which Dr. Ford's testimony of sexual assault by Judge Kavanaugh when they were in high school appears to present no more than a minor speed bump on the way to his confirmation, that's going to put Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court and change the court for our lifetimes. And so I want to know, how are you thinking about that river of freedom struggle right now? How we just get right in.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons I really appreciated being invited to this event and was glad to come, aside from the fact that we're old friends, is that so much of my work, which has been focused on mass incarceration in recent years, is often kind of described or framed as a civil rights issue or a racial justice issue or a criminal justice issue. It doesn't get framed as a human rights issue with universal global implications. And I think this moment that we're in, this particular moment, which is a moment about a Supreme Court justice, but it's also about something much, much more, right? It's about this ongoing struggle in this country to reimagine our democracy and reimagine what justice means. And, you know, in recent years, it's become more and more important, I think, and for me personally, and I hope for us collectively, to resist the temptation to get kind of caught up in the snapshot of the moment and to step back and try to appreciate where we stand through a broader lens, through the lens of history, and to see this moment, whatever moment we're in, as one moment in a centuries long struggle for freedom, equality, and justice for all in this country. And that centuries-long struggle has occurred within a global context in which people have struggled for justice and freedom and liberation in many different ways, in many different forms, since kind of the dawn of recorded history. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's undeniable that in this moment we're experiencing a lot of rage, we're experiencing anger and heartbreak and resentment and all of those feelings and emotions. But I think it's important for us, even in this snapshot of a moment, to recognize that what we see on our screens on television, what we see in social media, is really the very predictable kind of backlash or white lash or whatever you want to call it against the quickening pace of the radical evolution of American democracy. And in many ways, it would be very surprising if something like a Trump phenomenon did not occur in this moment. You know, we had centuries of slavery. You know, putting that in perspective of where we are in this moment, we're a nation that had slavery for centuries, which gave way to another system of racial and social control. We had centuries in which women did not have the right to vote and were treated much like property. And in fairly recent times, you know, we're talking like 50 years, it's just been the past 50 years that we've had this sudden, you know, surge, leap forward in our democracy, where suddenly, you know, black folks have the right to vote, women have the right to vote. You see, you know, people of different genders and sexual orientations claiming their rights to this space. You see this, you know, upsurge. Where a new America is struggling to be born. And throughout American history, every single time there has ever been any kind of, you know, great leap forward, it is always, predictably, you can set your watch to it, been met with violent, virulent resistance. Certainly that's been the case in the racial justice struggles, and Carol Anderson has written a wonderful book, White Rage, that describes how every single step forward for racial justice in this country has been met with just overwhelming virulent resistance. And so it isn't surprising, right? In this moment, you know, just decades after the Civil Rights Act, and less than a decade after the election of the first black president, and at a time when gay marriage has just been, you know, embraced by the U.S. Supreme Court, that there wouldn't be some kind of major backlash. And so we're seeing that right now. And I think the question is, how do we respond? And are we going to respond in this moment simply with blind rage? I think that would be a mistake. I think we need to see this as a moment in which there are multiple possibilities. A new America is struggling to be born, and what are we going to do in this moment to be midwives for this new nation and describe and articulate and name a new future, a new democracy, or are we just going to react and allow the forces of resistance? And I really believe Trump and those who voted for him represent the forces of resistance to the birth of this nation, set the terms of the debate and derail the movements that have emerged in recent years. And I don't want to paint some kind of picture of, you know, linear progress in American history. I mean, my book is all about how that is a false narrative, and that the birth of mass incarceration itself, you know, is in large part the product of the backlash against not only the civil rights movement, but also, you know, global capitalism and the way in which you know, certain communities have been devastated, and the economic insecurity that's been created has, you know, led to this kind of sense of there being a very small pie that we all must fight over along racial lines. So I hope that in this moment, while we're arguing over Brett Kavanaugh, that we recognize that this isn't just about whether some guy lied about his drinking or about whether or not he had a violent sexual history. This is really about, you know, whether or not we are going to, with courage, stand up for and demand that the highest court in the land represent kind of the values and the belief systems that we hold dear. What kind of justice system do we want? And what are we willing to tolerate and what aren't we? And that's what this moment is about. Mm-hmm. It's not just about this one guy and his apparent drinking problem.
If that were the least of it. And he's got a truth problem on top of it. I think that's really helpful, because I feel, I don't know, I think I'm not alone. I hope I'm not alone. It doesn't look like I'm alone. But in feeling like caught up in this moment, right, of just being like riveted and feeling so frustrated and feeling despair. So I think that frame is helpful. I'm also struck in this, in the recent history, like in the run-up to this white lash, if you will, right, and we're here in a law school, that law has been a central part, if not, well, central in the law school, but law has played a role in the social movements driving the change that you're talking about, birthing this new democracy. And I wonder how you're thinking about that going forward, right? Is law still that kind of still that kind of central role that you play? It. I mean, your book talks about really the reduced role of law's promise, mm-hmm. and in fact, the way that you expose the way that law, in some ways, was a willing midwife to mass incarceration, mm-hmm. and masked the ways in which it postured as something that was neutral, but operated as a system of racial and social control, mm-hmm. in particular communities. So, given that record, and that's the area that you've worked in so deeply, what role do you think that law can and should play going forward, not just in racial justice movements, but in any social justice movement, for that matter?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I went to law school filled with all of these really romantic ideas about the role of lawyers in the civil rights movement and the ability of lawyers to affect social change. You know, I just had this dream of wanting to be like a female Thurgood Marshall, helping to craft the next great legal strategy that was going to result in some Supreme Court decision where justice for all would kind of reign. And, you know, I look back on that and I was like, my God, what sort of miseducation did I receive? you know, in my high school and college years that would allow me to arrive in law school with that worldview. But that is, in fact, the worldview that I had, that, you know, Thurgood Marshall and, you know, his team of lawyers, you know, ended Jim Crow, and that there was still work to be done. You know, we're on the right path. So I have a long way to go, and that I was going to try to help finish the job that had been started by these civil rights lawyers that had come before me. And fortunately, when I was in law school, I went to Stanford Law School at a time when there were wonderful critical race and critical legal scholars there. I mean, it was phenomenal. I missed Derrick Bell by a year. He left just as I was arriving, but you know, there was Charles Lawrence and Mari Matsuda was visiting there, and Bill Hing and Jerry Lopez and Kim Taylor Thompson. I mean, I had this like all-star cast of really deep radical thinkers who were in the process of developing a curriculum called Lawyering for Social Change. And the curriculum was really designed to try to help law students think about the extent to which law could be used as a tool for social change. And we read a lot of Derrick Bell, and we read, you know, a lot of scholars who were very critical about whether law could be used as a tool for social change. And I remember reading Derrick Bell's critiques of civil rights lawyers and, you know, his argument that civil rights lawyers really had been corrupted, you know, during the civil rights movement and sold out their own clients, you know, clients who didn't actually want to integrate into white schools and wanted better black schools and well-funded black schools, but, you know, civil rights lawyers had their own agendas and didn't listen to their clients and pursued interests that were in conflict with them. And, you know, his argument that racism is permanent and no matter how many lawsuits you file, you're not actually going to end racism in America. You may mitigate it to some degree. I read all of that, and I loved it, and I digested it, and I still left thinking that somehow I was going to prove Derrick Bell wrong. And, you know, we worked together at Saperstein, Goldstein, Demchak, and Bowler, a plaintiff side, you know, civil rights law firm that specialized in these large class action lawsuits challenging Fortune 500 companies, challenging their, you know, we started off with sexual harassment cases and race discrimination cases at companies like Home Depot and public supermarkets. And sure enough, discovered in many of those cases we weren't necessarily representing the interests of our clients. And that we might be, in some cases, seeking monetary damages when injunctive relief was really what was required. And I came to see how quickly and easily it is possible for even the best lawyers with the best intentions to find themselves compromising and making decisions that are inconsistent with their client's own interests. But it wasn't until I was at the ACLU representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality and trying to put together large class action suits to challenge our criminal injustice system that I really began to have this sense of futility. That there was no class action lawsuit that was going to end the pervasive racial bias that was baked into our criminal justice system. And some cynicism really started creeping in for me as well, where I started thinking, wow, foundations are willing to spend millions of dollars funding these big impact cases. What we need are organizers. Why isn't this money going to grassroots organizations on the ground in these communities so they can build power rather than imagining that through some lawsuit somehow we can change the system? And so I went through a period of time, including the period of time when I was writing the book, where I had almost nothing good to say about the extent to which law could be used as a vehicle for social change. But I have to say now that I've recovered from that. And
you're on the other side?
No. What I would say is that, you know, I'm one of these people who actually believes that we're all kind of called to whatever it is that we're doing, you know? And if you find yourself called to be a lawyer in these times, people who are at the border and who are locked up really need nothing more than a lawyer. Like, that's what they need more than anything, a really good lawyer. That is a life-changing thing for someone to have access to a really good lawyer who will actually fight for them. And this notion that lawyers can't be a tool for social change is absurd when you see how much good lawyers can do, not just for individuals who are fighting, but also to support movements. You know, activists who are on the front lines in Ferguson and beyond, they needed lawyers to help them get out of jail and to fight when felony charges were, you know, put on them for nonviolent, you know, protest activities. They needed lawyers. And today, you know, I was just at the Legal Services for Prisoners with Children's brand new office in Oakland today. You know, they won a litigation that ended indefinite solitary confinement in California. Yeah. Those are heroic lawyers. So I think it's not a question of whether law can be used as a tool for social change, but for lawyers to understand their relationship to the movements of which they are a part and not leading, and that they're not the heroes and they're not going to save the day necessarily, but they can play critical, necessary, essential roles in movements. And we need lawyers as translators, as bridge people from the world of law and the courts and politics to communities that aren't fluent in those languages and don't understand how the systems work. And we need lawyers who are going to be fearless and willing to tell the truth about how the system operates as opposed to how it's advertised. And, you know, I think above all, I think we're going to need lawyers who are willing to embrace a radical imagination about the future of American democracy, who are not going to be content to working within the system as it is, but to be asking basic questions about how our legal system is designed and what our legal education looks like. That's something that lawyers can and should be doing. You know, why do we have an adversarial system? Why are basic economic rights not considered, you know, essential rights in our Constitution? Why is our system designed in the way that it is, and what would it look like to design a political system, to design a legal system where in which every voice and every life truly matters. Those are questions that lawyers can wrestle with and can provide useful tools and language, but it's not up to lawyers to answer those questions alone. Lawyers can work in partnership with communities as they strive to imagine alternatives to policing. What it would look like to have a community that isn't occupied by a militarized police force. What would it look like to design alternative systems? Lawyers can play important roles, but they're not going to be the movement leaders that save the day. And for me, I think what really hit, you know, struck home for me was when I came to realize that 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education in this country, virtually no schools in the South had desegregated. Nothing happened. It really took a mass movement to shift consciousness and to achieve any kind of, you know, material change. Mm-hmm. And even then, there was an enormous backlash that birthed another system of racial and social control. So as lawyers, we have a role to play, but in the end, it's people and communities who, you know, we have to support in their organizing and in their truth-telling so that the movements that we build are sustainable over time and that lawyers don't soak up the resources in ways that deprive communities of the organizing mm-hmm. tools that they need and deserve.
So you talked about, right, this, that community-based and community empowerment, community based change, and you know what would it mean to reimagine a justice system, and all of that sounds pretty revolutionary. You've actually used the word a need for a revolutionary movement when you talk about rejecting the frame of resistance to Trump to a positive framing of a need for a revolutionary movement that connects us all. So let's talk about this revolution a little bit. I want to know, so like, who is us in your in this conception of revolution, and what kind of revolution are you talking about? Because I was struck in your op-ed how you linked the movement against mass incarceration with the movement against mass deportation, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about that, and can those movements be united in a meaningful way? You offered it as a beautiful metaphor and a frame, but I kind of want to hear a little bit more about that. And if so, how do we build on that? How do we build on that vision? And do you see opportunities for transnational and even global social movements? Because we're really broadening that. It's not just happening in the United States, right? The migration that is bringing people to cross into the United States implicates larger chains, right? Larger chains of power and larger chains of oppression. Can those be brought together? And then finally, I want to get back to the point about capitalism. Do you think it's possible to have this social justice that you envision within a free market system? And if so, like, you know, how do we get there? Can we achieve this through this democracy that we have? Do we need a different
There's a
democracy?
Lot there.
I know. Discuss.
All right. All right. You know, I mean, I think first what I want to say is I want to be really clear that when I use the word like revolutionary movement, when I say revolutionary movement or revolution, I'm actually not using the word metaphorically. I believe that we need to think about what's required of us in these times as mustering the courage to embrace the task of the radical evolution of American democracy, an actual revolution. So what I do not believe our two-party pay-to-play political system will ever end poverty in the United States, will ever ensure that there are basic human rights extended to all. A two-party system in which the wealthiest elements of the society are able to select the candidates, fund their campaigns, guarantees certain results. You know, this isn't I talk to my kids, you know, who are in middle school about this, and you explain how the political system actually works, and it's like, well, that's not fair. Well, no, of course it's not fair. Our two-party political system that's dominated by money and the pay-to-play system has to be changed. We need a different kind of political system in order to ensure that every life and every voice truly matters in this country. And I also believe that our system, hyper-capitalism, global capitalism, is designed in a way in which some people will always be viewed as disposable and treated as such. And that is, for me, a reality that we have to face and be able to tell the truth about. And, you know, when Martin Luther King Jr., at the end of his life, you know, called for a revolution of values, he wasn't talking about a metaphorical revolution. He actually, in his speech, you know, the Beyond Vietnam speech he gave at Riverside Church in 1968, he made very clear that he felt it was time we get on the right side of the global revolutions that are struggling to be born in this country, I mean, around the world. And that, you know, racism and militarism and poverty, these are all linked, not just in the United States, but around the world. And that we have to reimagine. He said, America must be born again. Now, that has a religious connotation for sure. But really, I think if we think about it in political terms and economic terms, it's talking about reimagining our political system, reimagining our economic system in a way that ensures that everyone is treated with dignity and respect and has their basic human needs met. And so I think, you know, for a lot of reasons that would take much longer than we have here, it has become scary for people to think of themselves as revolutionaries or radicals. I think in our popular imagination, when we think of revolutionary, think of men with guns, people yelling with fists, and it's associated with violence. But what we've seen is that revolutionary nonviolence can shake the world. And we have to muster, I think, a commitment to articulating a radically different vision of American democracy. One that, you know, allows for the dignity and humanity of each and every one of us, no matter who we are, where we came from, or what we may have done. Articulating that vision and recognizing that when we get there, whatever that is, it will look, our nation will not look, will not be structured in a way that is structured today. The radical restructuring of American society is what Dr. King said at the end of his life, and he's of course become kind of whitewashed in many ways, but I think we have to somehow overcome our fears around claiming kind of those freedom dreams, those radical freedom dreams for ourselves, or we will stay forever on the defensive. And we will find ourselves constantly stuck in this cycle of tinkering with various systems only to have them adapt and morph and change form more and more rapidly. And I think a perfect example of this, I can't resist mentioning this right now, is that, you know, there's so much work that has been done to try to end mass incarceration, and finally, for the first time in 40 years, we're at a moment when, you know, people on both sides of the aisle, you know, are willing to acknowledge that our prison system has to be downsized in some way, and some reforms have occurred. But at the same time, these private prison companies, you know, having seen the writing on the wall, you know, recognizing that, oh, it looks like, you know, there's going to be some drug policy reform, it looks like our prisons may be downsized somewhat, these private prison companies are now investing in the tools of decarceration. So they are investing in GPS tracking monitors that are put on people. They're investing in home surveillance systems so that when people are put on house arrest rather than, you know, locked up in a physical cage, they'll be monitored and their conversations will be listened to 24/7. There are digital prisons that are now being built so that instead of being locked up for 5 years, you're going to be on an electronic monitor for 15. And there's a lot of money now being poured into these risk assessment systems and these algorithms that are being developed in order to predict future dangerousness. And arguments are being made today about, oh, perhaps we should begin putting GPS tracking monitors on people before they commit crimes. Maybe we should use these algorithms to remove children from homes in which they might likely be exposed to violence before any violence occurs. So I think as long as we find ourselves constantly kind of tinkering and reacting to these systems, we'll be in a place where these systems respond, and we won't be saying what we want instead is not an electronic monitor, but we want restorative justice. We want an entirely different system of justice. Instead of a re-entry program in which we're surveilled wherever we go, we want the right to work at a fair wage so that everyone is guaranteed work upon release from prison. You know, to be able to reframe what it is that we're fighting for so that we don't find ourselves constantly, reacting to the ways in which the system morphs and adapts over time. It's worth keeping in mind that mandatory sentencing itself was a progressive innovation as a way of trying to eliminate racial disparities in sentencing. But rather than fighting for education and jobs and ensuring that everyone has the right to work and has the right to quality education, if your goal then becomes a new sentencing scheme, you're going to find yourself with outcomes that actually wind up reinforcing the system and allowing for new systems of racial and social control to emerge, rather than fighting for, a different model of democracy and a different kind of economy.
Right, so a deeper decarceral state.
Yes.
Right, not a reimagined carceral state.
And that is what abolition democracy ultimately is. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's what the beauty is of Angela Davis's work and many others, is that they have insisted upon defining prison abolition in a way that makes clear that what we're fighting for is a democracy, the kind of democracy and the kind of economy in which prisons aren't required. And that is difficult for many of us to imagine, but then again, there are democracies right now, places like Norway and others where the rate of incarceration is a tiny fraction of what we have today, and even the prisons that do exist don't even really look like prisons compared to what we have here in the United States. And our capacity for imagining alternatives to what is has become so cramped and so limited that we find ourselves asking for, in response to police shootings and police killings, things like police body cameras. When police body cameras are not actually filming the police, who are police body cameras filming? Everyone else in the community they come into contact with. And so now we have these troves of video that's used against defendants in court, not necessarily used against police officers. So I hope that we will rekindle our radical imaginations, and I'm inspired by movements like Black Lives Matter, what occurred at Standing Rock. There's so much evidence that kind of younger generations are willing to do what, frankly, our generation did not do in the 90s, at a time when the war on drugs, the war on welfare, the war on the expanded vision for beloved community was really mm-hmm. under assault.
So we're going to open it up. I'm going to turn to Q&A, but one more question for you before we do. So I want to give you an opportunity to share with us your decision about kind of turning your transition from focusing on mass incarceration and looking at law, looking at that through the prism of law, to your decision actually to kind of move away from law, at least as your intellectual home. And so about 2 years ago, you resigned your position from the law faculty at Ohio State, and you're now on the faculty of Union Theological Seminary in New York. And so I'm curious, what prompted your decision to move away from law and into and towards spirit?
Yeah, well, you know, there are a lot of reasons, you know. One of them is that I started to find that the discourse within the legal academy was so constrained and so narrow. That
does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, that...
I don't know what you're talking about, Michelle.
Yes, that, you know, as I became more and more interested in what was necessary, not just to reduce mass incarceration, but to end the system of mass incarceration and to end this history and cycle of birthing caste-like systems in America, as I became more interested in what it would take, what it would require, not just in terms of power and organizing capacity, but in terms of our consciousness, I started looking at, well, who is interested in these questions? Who's willing to talk to me about it? In the legal academy, I was finding that there weren't people who were really interested in having those kinds of conversations. People were interested in having conversations about how to reform the sentencing system, or really how to tinker with the machine. But I was really interested in trying to wrestle with those other kinds of questions. And much to my surprise, because I don't identify as a Christian, I was not raised in a church, I started finding that when I would go to churches and mosques and faith communities, these deeper questions around liberation and what it really means were alive. And people were willing to have them. Now, this, for me, was kind of surprising. And I was invited by Vincent Harding, who was the author of King's Beyond Vietnam speech, and who I cited in my op-ed. I was invited by him to speak at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, where he was then on the faculty. And he said for me to come and speak, and it was at a time when my book was fairly new, and I was kind of giving a standard new Jim Crow speech. And at the end of it, you know, he pulled me over and he said, you know, I want to thank you, Sister Michelle, for your work and the contributions that you're making and all of that. He said, but I think there's actually a deeper message you are trying to communicate here. There's something deeper that you're reaching for that you may not even be aware of. And he said, what I think you're really trying to say is what you do the least of these, my brother, and you do unto me. Mm. So that's the core message here, that the very least of us have divinity, have value, have dignity, and that is the core of it. And there was something about that conversation, and that after that we began having all kinds of dialogues, and he sent me the book Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman, and I started becoming interested in how faith traditions have thought about justice and liberation. And I became interested in liberation theology, not just black liberation theology, but the many liberation theologies that exist around the world, and realized that all of our conceptions about what justice is really are traceable in some way to faith traditions. Their origins go that far back, and to reconnect with what different faith traditions have to teach us about what justice means and what liberation actually means. And increasingly, I've come to feel that what's required of us isn't simply building more political power or more political will, but a fundamental shift in consciousness so that it is possible for us to kind of imagine another way of living and being with one another. And, you know, those are conversations that necessarily happen in the traditional law school classrooms. But I think it's a conversation
worth having right now. And that ultimately the question of how we respond to a young woman with a child in her arm on the border is not just a political question. On some level, it's a spiritual question. Whether or not you believe in God, it's a question of how we relate on a very human level to this other spirit in the world. And I hope that, you know, in the months and years to come, as we do this work of reimagining American democracy, that we will center kind of the dignity and humanity of each and every one of us, no matter who we are, what we've done, where we've come from. We will center that in our work and in our imaginings and in our struggle, because if we don't, if we imagine it's just a power struggle or a power game, I think we will find ourselves forever trapped in rebirthing these systems and cycles of control.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I'm going to turn to a few of the questions.
Isn't she great?
And I'm so glad. We're going to go all night. No, we won't, but we could. And thank you for bringing that into the law school. I think that this is one of the ways that we actually build that conversation into the law school, is to take this conversation and disperse it into the other conversations that happen in the law school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and animate doctrine with spirit, mm-hmm. right? Because if we're about justice, we take this seriously, it needs to find expression mm-hmm. in our institutions and our mm-hmm. and our laws. So first question is, what has changed in the mass incarceration system since the new Jim Crow, your book, came out in 2010? And what has changed in the fight against mass incarceration? What changes have you seen?
Well, I mean, I talked a little bit about that already. I mean, it's really stunning when I think back to when the book, when I was researching and writing the book, the topic of mass incarceration was one that was discussed to some extent in academic circles and some policy circles, but it was not a topic of public debate or concern. And I was really I was just deeply concerned about the fact that the civil rights community itself had not made mass incarceration a priority, had not made this war on drugs, which had functioned as a literal war on poor communities of color, a top priority, that there was just this silence, this eerie silence about the devastation that had been, you know, wreaked on communities of color. And so I was really taken by this desire to, like, wake people up, try to, you know, force this into the public domain. But, you know, the timing of the book wound up, you know, being really quite fortuitous in the sense that the book, when it first came out, Obama had just been elected and we were awash in this post-racialism. And, you know, honestly, for the first 2 years, I begged people to let me talk about the book. I was like speaking in half-empty church basements and calling up my friends. Don't you know anybody who wants to come here? You know, just really trying to figure out how can I get this message out. And it was virtually impossible. And I spent 2 years doing that, traveling and speaking and trying to get folks to listen. And then finally, about 2 years in, not only was the novelty of Obama's election kind of beginning to wear off, but the economic crisis that was afflicting so many states back then, as states were going bankrupt after, you know, the stock market crash and all of that, you know, so many former Get Tough True Believers, people who had been campaigning on kind of this Get Tough rhetoric, suddenly realized that there was no way to balance their state budgets, to save their, you know, states from insolvency without dealing with this massive prison state, or else they'd have to raise taxes on the predominantly white middle class. But there was just no way around it. And so, you know, suddenly there was this opening where people were willing to think and talk about mass incarceration and how we got here. And so that opening, I think, created an opportunity for the message suddenly to be heard. And, you know, but I really think that the progress that we've made to date has been driven primarily by economics and also by the extraordinary youth movements that have emerged. You know, Ferguson and Black Lives Matter and the astonishing youth organizing has forced, you know, criminal injustice to the, you know, forefront of the national conversation. And so we are right now in a moment where, you know, there are, you know, like Prop 47 here in California, we have legalization of marijuana, things that 10 years ago had just been unimaginable, have occurred. And yet at the same time, you know, we see this shape-shifting of the system. And, you know, one of my kind of obsessions right now is trying to prevent liberals and progressives from unwittingly being accomplices to the birth of a new system of racial and social control. So, you know, for example, you know, it was progressives and liberals who, you know, fought quite rightly to end mental institutions, mental hospitals, because we were so appalled, you know, by how people with mental illness were being treated in these facilities. And one, the closing of mental, you know, hospitals, these horrible mental institutions all over the country, and yet now the result, you know, many are arguing now is worse than what we had before because mental illness, people with mental illness are primarily cared for in prison today. And so instead of birthing some other new system of care and compassion for people with mental illness, we tore down one system only to have people with mental illness shuttled into another system, which was arguably even worse. Like I mentioned, mandatory sentencing was kind of a progressive idea. But because we hadn't cultivated a consciousness of care and concern for poor people and people of color, mandatory sentencing ended up becoming a tool for mass incarceration and helped to lead to the exponential increase of our prison population. The same thing with body cameras on police officers. And today, now, we have this push to that's embraced by many liberals and progressives to view electronic monitors and in-home surveillance and all these things as alternatives to incarceration. These are not alternatives to incarceration. These are different kinds of incarceration. You're still under, you know, a system of racial and social control. You are not free. Anybody who has an electronic monitor will tell you, I would rather have this slapped on my ankle than be in a cage. And yet, I'm still not free. And so I think we have to just be very careful about the extent to which we wind up being kind of unwitting accomplices, because I can easily imagine now entire communities being under perpetual surveillance and monitoring to a degree we can't even imagine today. In the same way that, you know, 40 years ago, no one would have imagined a system like mass incarceration. And so I hope that we will be forward thinking, not only in terms of what we want to create, but be very conscious of the ways in which the system is adapting and changing in ways that we really ought to be prepared for.
Right. I think that's the technology has proven to get the better of us, right, time and time again. And so, right, digital, in effect, you know, virtual prisons, but nonetheless prisons, I think is anyway, I love that kind of framing. So we need to be vigilant. We need to be vigilant. So let's bring it back down to the law school and what's going on in law schools. What would be required to make law school a force for social justice? And should lawyers organize to protest law? Should we be part of
it? That would be interesting. yeah, you know, it's really interesting. When I was a law student, we were And I should emphasize, when I was a law student, not only were the faculty involved in this process of developing this curriculum, Lawyering for Social Change, but the faculty was doing it in partnership with the students. Students and faculty were brainstorming and strategizing and collaborating on what the classes ought to look like, what should be read, what shouldn't. How should they be designed? To what extent should these classes be done in partnership with other organizations, grassroots organizations of the community? These were debates and conversations that were happening about what does it look like to, you know, develop some kind of curriculum, some form of education that will prepare us to be, you know, lawyers that are actually servants of justice as opposed to part of a system that, you know, replicates inequality. And virtually all of those professors were either denied tenure, left in protest. At that time, it was considered too political to have a Lawyering for Social Change curriculum or program, not recognizing, of course, that the entire curriculum was designed to train law students to go into corporate law. That was what the entire curriculum was geared to do, and that was considered apolitical. That didn't have a political mission. But if you tried to design a, you know, curriculum to train people to do social justice, that was considered too political. And there was a huge, horrible, vicious battle that resulted in the dismantling of that program. I would love to see an effort like that, perhaps one is already underway, here at Berkeley, where, you know, students and faculty come together to ask the question, what do we need to know to understand? What questions should we be wrestling with? What kind of training do we need in order to prepare us to be agents, servants of, you know, movements for liberation, as opposed to kind of mere cogs in a wheel? And so I would hope that those are questions that really get wrestled with. I don't have the recipe. There's no blueprint for it necessarily. But I think it's a worthwhile mission. And I don't know about protesting law in itself in the generic fashion, but I do think that there's a stunning silence of the legal community as a whole in this age of mass incarceration. You know, so I ask myself always, like, where are the judges? Where are the lawyers? Where is the legal community with a conscience rising up to speak out against this human rights nightmare that's occurring on our watch? And, you know, I would hope that, you know, part of legal education would include what, you know, effectively is kind of what doctors have, a Hippocratic oath, right? Do no harm. And when harm is being done, this understanding that you, as an officer of the court, as someone who has a law degree and is trained in this legal system, has a responsibility to stand up and speak against injustice and in a way that is consistent with kind of your ethical obligations, not just those who, you know, openly affiliate as a social justice lawyer or activist.
Yeah, taking back the curriculum is, I mean, that's a project, right? I mean, that's what you're describing.
Yes.
is a project that maybe it was too soon at Stanford at that time, but I think it's you offer that as a really positive idea that could be given texture, right? Not just at Berkeley, but ideally around the country. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, how can you possibly teach a criminal procedure course without giving the context of the drug war and the system of mass incarceration? And how can you read cases where there's no reference being made to the, you know, racial identities or the class backgrounds of the people involved? I mean, there's just a way in which I think legal education, to a large extent, has been stuck, even as the challenges and the nature of, you know, the challenges to our democracy have moved on. So,
Well, we have our Felton Henderson Center for Social Justice here, so and Ian's part of that. So, note to, yeah. Well, we are doing that, so we're going to get on this. Okay, another question. You advocated for reacting with reason and strategy to scary moments like this confirmation, but to those who are not reacting out of anger but out of fear, what coping and self-care and resistance strategies do you suggest?
Oh, that's such a great question. Because, you know, I actually went this past summer to a 5-day silent meditation retreat hosted by and for people of color. And the theme of that meditation retreat was decolonize your mind. Right? And in many ways, I think what we're all in need of is learning how to care for ourselves, become quiet, to engage in healing, and all kinds of practices. Meditation is one that's been very difficult for me. But what I see now, that one of the benefits of it is I've become more aware of the insane thoughts that occupy my mind that really aren't my own. How do they get there? Where did these thoughts come from? My mind has been colonized. And these thoughts that we all have that make us think that we need to compete, to fight, to react, struggle, to get ahead, or to pay back, or all of these ideas aren't just the sort of personality flaws. Oh, I can't believe I would think that thought. Why? Where did that thought come from? But in so many ways, capitalism, our political system, right, the ways in which we've been socialized, the media, many of our thoughts aren't really our own, of our own choosing. And I think developing in community rituals and spaces where we can come together, take care of one another, and decolonize our minds, I think is really essential if we're going to find a way to kind of think out of the box and engage in kind of radical imagination and self-care that will allow us to sustain ourselves for the long run. And so that's what I'm working on myself. And I encourage everyone else to figure out what that looks like for them.
And for those who don't know, we do have a meditation room in the law school just upstairs. So yeah, making good use of it. Do you fear that the racial solidarity among communities of color and with white people under Trump will fracture in a post-Trump era?
Read that again.
Do you fear that the racial solidarity that we're seeing today among communities of color and with whites under in this moment is going to fracture in a post-Trump era? Is this going to hold together?
The racial solidarity?
It's the question. It's not my.
Yeah.
To the extent, is there racial solidarity?
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure about that. You know, I think that one of the biggest challenges, and actually you alluded to this in your question when you asked kind of who is the us? Who is the us that we're fighting for? Who is the us? And I think one of the greatest challenges we face is figuring out how the us can be all of us. And, you know, the organization All of Us or None, which is an organization of formerly incarcerated and convicted people who have been organizing brilliantly
for the restoration of their basic civil and human rights. That organization is founded on this notion that it's got to be all of us or none, right? And I remember actually it was even before my book was published, it was in manuscript form, and I gave a talk at Ohio State to the faculty about the book before it came out, and one of the members of the faculty who remained unnamed said to me, you know, wow, like I really buy your thesis. He says, but if it's not going to be black men who are the enemy, who's it going to be? We need an enemy. Like every nation, every culture needs an enemy, needs an other in order to define itself. And so who's it going to be? You know, is it going to be the Muslims? Is it going to be immigrants? Is it going to be what? Like, there's going to have to be an other in order for a culture to have a sense of itself. And, you know, I think really the task that lies ahead is whether we can develop really a democracy in which there is no other. And there's a lot of reason for skepticism that project is possible. I mean, Vincent Harding himself would often begin his talks by saying, is America possible? It's a question that has not yet been answered. Is this whole project, this idea, even possible? And there's enormous research that shows that, you know, the most punitive countries in the world are the most racially diverse. And the most homogeneous ones are the ones that are more likely to not only have less punitive criminal justice systems, but are also more likely to have generous public welfare systems and all. That there is something about the other that seems to make humans more punitive, even in countries that lack our history of slavery. And so, you know, I think the real question, the challenge for us is, can we as a nation, and again, for me, this is in part a spiritual question, can we overcome what may be a natural human tendency, impulse, to be fearful of and punitive towards the other, and redefine the other in a way in which it vanishes? And so that we have the sense that it really is all of us or none. Every life, every voice truly matters. And whether we can do that in our democracy, I think, is an open question. But it is what I'm willing to fight for. And I think that's really the question, is whether we, you know, as a people, are willing to say, we are willing to fight for this radical idea that it is possible to create a democracy in which every life and every voice truly matters, no matter who you are, where you came from, what you've done, and that every single one of us is entitled to basic human rights and dignity. There isn't proof that such a thing is possible. But unless we're willing to fight for it, there's no chance it will ever be.
Yes. next question. Is there a connection between a new multiracial democracy and an economy that produces a broadly shared prosperity? Sort of another take on that. Can we all get there together?
Well, you know, it's possible to have a multiracial, extremely unequal democracy. I mean, Brazil, for example, is an example of a nation that is very multiracial and has wildly unequal. And Ian has written brilliantly about why it's mistaken to imagine that just the demographic changes that are occurring in our country alone are going to magically result in kind of the embrace of more progressive values or a more egalitarian democracy, that there's plenty of reason to believe that the opposite might be true, and that whiteness has a way of adapting to changes in demographics, and that, you know, if you look at, you know, South Africa, or look like places like Brazil and see that a small racial minority, even within a multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy, is able to monopolize wealth and power. And so I don't think that a multiracial democracy, even when everybody gets to vote, even when everybody in prison and outside of prison has a right to vote, even when everybody gets to the polls on election day, will necessarily result in a more egalitarian democracy. And I think that's why it's critically important for us to understand our challenges being one not only of reimagining our political system, but also recognizing the necessity of reimagining our economic system, and that the two go hand in hand. But it is not necessarily the case that just by diversifying our democracy, we will necessarily, have a more egalitarian economy.
Right. I mean, I think the human rights piece of it and the valuing dignity has got to infuse and suffuse the politics in order for that to change. Right. Both things need to be happening.
Yes. And I think we have to ask ourselves, are we fighting for an equal number of Black and Latino and Asian billionaires? Like, is that the goal? Is that the end goal? It's not mine. But it is some people's, right? Mm-hmm. So, I think that's part of it, too, is really kind of challenging ourselves to, become clear on what it is we're actually fighting for. Mm-hmm. And, right now there are many people, in communities of color who have this idea that the goal, the American dream, is actually to have kind of an equal piece of this pie. And to have an equal number of people who are on, the boards of Wall Street banks and who have access to wealth and power. But I would argue that, that really should not be our goal, that our goal really has to be rooted in, the dignity and humanity of each and every one of us and making sure everyone's needs are met.
Right, that's one of the first principles.
Absolutely.
Around which the other politics then gets organized.
Yeah. Foundational.
Next question. Do you think the U.S. would ever engage in a truth and reconciliation process?
Not tomorrow, but...
ever?
No, I think that truth and reconciliation... something like a truth and reconciliation process... is not only essential, but is already happening in some places as Confederate statues are coming down and the kinds of debates that are happening in many communities about why they were up in the first place. So for me, when I see these Confederate statues coming down and the arguments and the debates that are happening around this, for me, this is like part of the rebirthing, right? Our new nation requires new heroes, new statues, new holidays, new... We can't stick with the heroes of the Confederacy if we're going to, birth a new multiracial, multiethnic, egalitarian democracy. So I don't know whether a truth and reconciliation process where people go state by state, city by city, is likely to happen in the near future. But I do think it's worth considering as part of the process of reckoning with our past and imagining what our collective future really ought to be. I was speaking with someone today who was pointing out that Germany is one of the countries in Europe that so far to date has kind of done the best job of staving off this kind of right-wing nationalism. And that, many believe that one of the reasons Germany has done a bit of a better job is because of its history of reckoning with their past in a way that our nation never has, that Britain never has. So I don't imagine how we can ever have the kind of multiracial, multiethnic, egalitarian democracy that I want to dream of without some means of reckoning with our past. James Baldwin argued that it would be the process of fighting for socialism in this country that would force us to reckon with our past in order to get to a place where basic human rights would be secured for mm-hmm. all, that it would be that process of fighting for socialism that might well force us to deal with the reasons why we are so reluctant to ensure quality education or health care for certain of us, but not others.
Right. I mean, you'd have to confront that head on. And I think that, you know, I think of it, you know, our nation would have to exercise its humility muscle, right? Yeah. That a reconciliation process requires to be humbled and about one's own uncomfortable history, right? And
yes.
I think that that is not a muscle that we have been willing to exercise, right?
No.
And it becomes harder and harder to do that.
Yeah.
Last question. How do you see immigration policies and mass incarceration intersecting?
From my perspective, the movements to end mass incarceration and the movements to end mass deportation really are one movement that haven't yet self-consciously understood themselves as one movement. I mean, the politics that birth mass incarceration are so stunningly similar to the politics that birth mass deportation. You know, mass incarceration arose at a moment of demographic change, profoundly demographic change. Suddenly, all of this African-American population that had formerly been, you know, subordinated to a permanent second-class status, suddenly, with the Civil Rights Act, were on the same legal terms and were able to compete on the same terms with this whole other population. That was a demographic shift. This was suddenly people felt threatened by the emergence of this new racially defined group of people that was threatening white supremacy, that was forcing people to compete for scarce jobs in an environment of scarcity. This all occurred at a time when work was vanishing, factories were closing down and moving overseas, and there was this panic of work disappearing, and now suddenly black folks were being given rights and even affirmative action in a way that produced this backlash. People wanted to get tough on them. And with mass deportation, the same kinds of politics played out. And, you know, with the demographic changes and economic insecurity playing out in ways that made it easy for politicians to say, get tough on them. And in the era of the war on drugs, we built walls, prison walls, and today we're building walls along the border as a result of politicians exploiting racial anxiety, economic anxiety in very similar ways. And the core question is whether we are going to view some people as disposable, mm-hmm. Whether we're willing to throw them away and lock them up, throw away the key, send them back to wherever they came from. And so I hope that we come to see these movements to end mass incarceration and movements to end mass deportation really as movements that are about kind of redefining or reclaiming, rebirthing the soul of American democracy. You know, does every life truly matter? Are we going to recognize the dignity and humanity of each and every one of us? Are we going to allow the losers of global capitalism, right? The people who were left jobless in Detroit, left jobless in inner cities in Chicago, who had to deal with the aftermath of global capitalism and, you know, quote-unquote third world countries and the related violence and who are fleeing it to come to the United States, are we going to view those losers of global capitalism as people that need to be controlled and disposed of by any means necessary? Or are we willing to view the least of these, right, as our sisters and brothers and to see the dignity and divinity in them? That's the same question at the core of both movements. And I think answering them in the affirmative, yes, we do care and stand in solidarity with them, quote unquote, least of these, answering those in the affirmative will be the engine of reimagining what our democracy can and should be.
Thank you. Wow. please.
Beyond the applause, I would actually like to ask that in this spirit of meditation that you take a moment, just a moment, to be quiet and to think about what you've just heard and to think about how that speaks to you and changes your vision of what you're doing with your own life. Just for a moment. So let me call us back together. It's my really unfortunate obligation to draw this conversation to a close. There are so many more questions that you wrote. I want to assure you I will give them to Michelle. I'm sure that she will read them. I want to remind you that there's a reception that I hope you'll all attend. I actually want to just kind of lift up a few of the questions as a way to draw this to a close. Why do you think children are increasingly being used at this moment in time? What would a world without prisons look like? Can you comment on white liberal racism? Spared you that one.
Yes.
How do we combat a violent system with nonviolence? And my favorite question of all, Michelle, I love you. That, I think, is a sentiment that many, most, all of us share. We love you both. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much to both of you for being here. We're really, really profoundly grateful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.